So, continuing talking about Walt Whitman here, Leaves of Grass, and specifically Song of Myself. Remember we talked about how Whitman was from Brooklyn, and Brooklyn, on one side of him, he had Long Island, where he'd go back to visit his family, farmland. The other side of him, Manhattan, New York City, the first modern city. And there he is, kind of coming back to Brooklyn at night to, mull it all over and put it together, kind of in the middle of those things. And in a similar way, he would be kind of passing through all these experiences and experiencing things that had, some of which had never existed before, like, all the wonders of the modern city and the growth of the United States into something that it had never, that had never been before, a nation like that. And also many great things that had existed for eons, like the stars and the forests and the oceans and so forth. And this great sort of multiplicity, this great richness of life, all these different experiences, which are so just vast, such a vast kind of tapestry of different experiences. And yet, where are all the experiences being experienced? Who or what is experiencing them all? The experiencer, the awareness, the self. So, in a sense, the self must be so great, so vast, that it can contain all those experiences. It must contain the stars, the heavens, the galaxies, the continents, all the different people that you behold with all their different professions and so forth, all the different states and conditions of life that seem so diverse, and it somehow unites all those states into united states. Okay. So we could sort of conceive it like this. Here's the self in the middle. Surrounding it are all these various kinds of experiences. Here's, the city and the country, and here's the stars and the galaxies, and here's all the different kinds of people, and here's all the president and the prostitutes and all that. And that's all contained within the self. It all kind of converges on the self. The self, the awareness, is in the middle of it all. And also, for that matter, the self is out here at the edge, surrounding it all, because it's all, we could say, converging on the self, and at the same time, in a sense, it's all contained within the self, since the self is that which experiences it all. So you see, this gives us a kind of a, just this is just sort of a way to pi of picturing this graphically, this kind of wheel. And what I'm really sort of echoing here is a kind of pattern that's found in Buddhist art and Tibetan and Hindu art that's called a mandala. And I want to show you some examples. Of mandalas. We go. So, here's what, can you all see this? So here's an example. Does this kind of look familiar? Maybe you've seen things like this before. This is a Tibetan mandala, and if you look, it's probably hard to see from where you are. But in the middle here, of all these concentric circles, is a Buddha, because the Buddha is this symbol of the self, the enlightened self, the boundless awareness. And then all around the outside are a bunch of Buddhas, and in between are all these concentric circles and kind of spokes and pathways and so forth that all kind of represent the all the multiplicity of life and the different kinds of experiences that one can have. Here's another one. Here, maybe you can see the Buddha in the middle a little more clearly. Yeah. Well,
are they like in the form of like a tapestry or something? These particular ones, these are Tibetan ones, and they're in the form of what's called tanka painting, which is it's painted on cloth, painted on fabric, and generally hung inside on the walls of temples. There are some in Tibet that are giant, that actually they have to unfurl it down like this, like the face of a big hill. Okay, here's and actually, technically speaking, the Tibetan mandalas are actually like an aerial view of a temple, and the temple represents the whole universe, the whole cosmos. And as in any traditional temple, at the very center, in the sanctum sanctorum, the holy of holies, what's there? Some representation of the deity, of God, if it's from one of the theistic religions, or if it's Buddhism, Buddha, again, being the self, the enlightened, totally, you know, expansive awareness within which everything else is experienced. Here's something that may be familiar to some of you. Right? Rose window from a Christian church. But it looks a whole lot like a mandala, doesn't it? It's much the same idea. Here at the center is a cross, a Christ. Who, in Christian terms, Christ is the Buddha. Christ is the anointed one or the enlightened one, the self at the highest level. And everything converges upon that. This is a Hopi Indian painting. Much simpler, but the different colors represent what are they're called the different nations. You know, the Buffalo Nation and the Eagle Nation, and so forth. Which in the Native American cosmology, that is all those nations taken together represent the wholeness of life. So again, from E Pluribus Unum, United States, all those different conditions, all the diversity of the world coming together as a unity. Okay. So, let's take a look, kind of bearing that in mind, let's take a look at the text.
Wait, what did Emerson?
Oh, yes. So, Whitman, I think I mentioned, self-published this book. So he had complete control. He took all the risk. He invested the money in having it printed, and then he would get the profits. And it was a fairly audacious thing to do. So he's this idealistic, transcendental poet, but he was also a very practical guy who was very much interested in promoting himself, self-promoting his career as a poet. So he sent out complimentary copies to a number of people. And one of the people he sent a copy to was Emerson. It was a very shrewd move. Emerson was the numero uno literary figure of the day. Now, you may recall that one of Emerson's essays written years before was called The Poet, where Emerson essentially said that the poet is not just a guy making pretty verses. The poet is like a prophet. Is like an enlightened sage, is like who taps into the whole pulse of the country, the pulse of the universe, and expresses that in rhythmic words. But at the end of his essay, The Poet, Emerson says, I search in vain for the poet of whom I speak. In other words, that's what a poet should be, but I don't see any like that around here. Now, when he received his copy of Leaves of Grass from Whitman, he wrote back and said, essentially, you're the guy I've been waiting for. You are the poet. I congratulate you on the beginning of a brilliant career. Wow, how exciting to be this nobody from nowhere, from Brooklyn, when the whole cultural center was Boston, and send your little, hopeful little book of poetry off to the number one guy and get back such a letter. Now, of course, Whitman right away, also being a shrewd businessman, took out ads in newspapers where he reprinted Emerson's letter, which Emerson had just meant it as kind of a private letter, and here Whitman is turning around, turning it into a commercial. But it worked. And he really essentially lived as a poet for the rest of his life. And Leaves of Grass became very successful, very controversial. A lot of people considered it to be vulgar, obscene, pornographic. Did you guys see a film on Friday? Did that go into that, some of that? Was the film helpful at all? No, sorry. Okay. A lot of people condemned it. As you'll see, his vision embraces everything, all of life, including sexuality, is a very important, very powerful part of life. And he dealt with it in ways that were frank and forthright, that was kind of unprecedented. And a lot of people said, oh, this must be porn. They were not officially Puritans anymore. But unofficially, there are people with the Puritan temperament, Puritan attitude were still around and are still around to this day. So to them, anything that deals with sex in a forthright way is like, oh, there's something naughty about that. There's that Puritan repression, which, Remy, you've been exploring very deeply through that play. So sexual repression turns into all kinds of craziness, doesn't it? Now, in the front of the book, Thoreau put a picture of himself, which you have on your little picture sheet that I gave you. Do you all have that? You take a look. I want you to be looking at that picture. If you don't have it handy, you lean over it. The second picture sheet I gave you. The second picture sheet. Billy, you're looking at the first picture sheet.
It's also...
Oh, yes, on the writing assignment. There you go. Yeah, it's on the writing assignment. So that picture was the frontispiece of the 1855 edition of Leaves of Grass. Frontispiece means a picture that's put up in the beginning of a book near the title page. Even that picture was revolutionary. Right? The content of the book was revolutionary. The form, being free verse, was revolutionary. I want you to take a good look at that picture. Look at the other portraits you have there of authors. Look at Poe. Look at Emily Dickinson. If you've got the earlier picture sheet, look at Emerson and Thoreau. Even Thoreau, the eccentric who lived out in the woods, when he has his picture taken, what does he look like? Yeah, I mean, actually, there's the Thoreau's photo there. He's all dressed up in his Sunday best. He's trying to be a gentleman. He's trying to be upper class. How is Whitman dressed? Yes, he's dressed casually. He's standing casually. He's wearing a peasant blouse open at the collar. He's not wearing a tie and a high collar. He's wearing a peasant's hat. He's standing, and also notice it's not just showing his face. Usually an author's portrait is just a picture of like a severed head, as if only the head is important. But here we see the rest of the body, implying that the body is important. And how is the body standing? Notice it's off balance. He's got his weight on one foot. One hip is stuck out slightly. A hand is on the hip. It's a casual, cool, somewhat sexy look for the time. Look at his eyes. What kind of look is that? Maybe a look of challenge, maybe a look of defiance, maybe some hint of bedroom eyes there. A sexy look. So that picture was very important. That signaled an attitude that was new and fresh, that, whoa, what's going on here? Elvis is in the building. I think we've talked about this before. When Elvis came on the scene, with that kind of raw sexuality and that fresh rhythm that he represented, there hadn't been anything like it before. So Whitman was kind of like the Elvis of poetry. Okay? So, with all this in mind, let's go into the text. Page 116, section 1. I celebrate myself and sing myself, and what I assume, you shall assume. For every atom belonging to me, as good belongs to you. Okay. The very first word of the poem, I celebrate myself. And I think, you know, we talked a little bit about this before. How does it come off? Massive arrogance. Massive, at the very least, self-confidence. I celebrate myself and sing myself. But of course, there's some precedent for it. Emerson talked about self-reliance. Now here's a guy really doing it, really walking the talk. Relying on himself enough to celebrate himself, sing himself. And what I assume, you shall assume. That sounds pretty arrogant. You're gonna take up my view. But you know what? There's another meaning to the word assume. What else does assume mean? Yes, take on, like when you assume a mortgage or assume a role. Take on. So that's something broader, not just meaning, oh, you will take my opinions at face value. What I assume, you shall assume, you will take it on. Well, what is he taking on? We've got to stay tuned. Now he's piquing our curiosity. For every atom belonging to me as good belongs to you. Whoa, that changes everything, doesn't it? As we said the other day. This is an I. This is a self, which apparently, we are all interchangeable. And, you know, of course, this is literally the case. Every atom belonging to me as good belongs to you. We think of ourself as being this stable collection of components, you know, organs and molecules and atoms. But is it stable? No, it's constantly changing. We think of this book. This is a book. This is a state. But what was this before? This was tree. Right? This is paper. It was tree. And before it was tree, it was solar energy radiating from the sun and minerals coming up from the earth and water falling from the sky and coming up through the earth. And all of that pulled together by the leaves and the root system of the tree. And then the tree turned into paper. And I could take this page and set it on fire. I could burn this book. And what would happen? The smoke would rise up into the sky. Some of that moisture would go back up into the clouds. The dust, the ashes would go back into the earth and would continue to recycle. This is the same thing with our bodies. I once read that this has something to do with Avogadro's number or something. But that, you know, 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. If Columbus, you know, we can assume at least at one point during the, probably several points during the voyage, took a whiz into the ocean, that the H2O contained in his whiz by now has become so spread throughout the system of the world that some of that H2O is circulating in your blood right now. You know, the blood of Christ is in my cup of coffee, literally. Every atom belonging to me as well belongs to you. We're all in this big molecule soup together. We are this molecule soup together. So maybe it's a molecule chowder. You know, here and there the soup kind of coalesces into one being over here and we call it Morgan, another one over here, we call it Billy, and another one over here, we call it the whiteboard, another one over here, we call it the computer. But, you know, over time, it's all changing. It's all percolating and simmering in that big chowder together. You know, it's a very vast, expansive view of life, at which he just socks us with in the third line. For every atom belonging to me as good belongs to you. So it's a very transcendental view, we could say. Right? So in the next line, he showed, well, how do we get in touch with the transcendent? I loaf and invite my soul. Now, usually loafing was considered a bad thing. Loafing meant being lazy. But he's celebrating loafing. Because loafing is more than just being lazy. It's inviting your soul. When you become less active, what most people call lazy, you become less active, somehow the wholeness of your soul, the wholeness of your awareness of what you are, becomes more, of course, it's there all the time. You know, we are that oversoul, we are that cosmic molecule chowder all the time, but usually we don't notice it. We get caught up in thinking, well, I'm just this small thing. But by becoming more quiet, less active, we can invite the soul, reconnect with the wholeness of the whole mandala of the self and of the universe. That's what in some places is called meditation or mindful awareness. Right? You become quiet and that experience more of that wholeness. You life and invite your soul. I lean and loaf at my ease, observing a spear of summer grass. So here he for the first time introduces the motif of grass. Remember the name, the title of the book is Leaves of Grass. So this motif of grass, as you'll see, continues through the whole poem, used in different ways. My tongue, every atom of my blood formed from this soil, this air, born here of parents, born here from parents the same and their parents the same. So you see how he sees himself as just part of this ongoing process down through the generations. And also there's this feeling of being connected to this soil, America. He saw America as a special place. Maybe if you were following the election closely, you heard this phrase, American exceptionalism. This is an idea that's been around for a long time, that there's something special about America. It's not just another country. It's not Belgium. Because it's the United States, there's just something about being born here, about a kind of a wholeness, a sprawling diversity. This is the place for them. I, now 37 years old, in perfect health, begin. Oh, in perfect health. The body is important, not just the mind. Celebrating the body. Hoping to cease not till death. Creeds and schools in abeyance. Okay, creeds meaning religions. Schools meaning philosophies. In abeyance means suspended. Please check your beliefs at the door. You know, there's a famous Zen story about a professor of philosophy who goes to a Zen master. And he says, please teach me Zen. And the Zen master says, okay, but first let's have a cup of tea. And he fills up the professor's teacup, but then he keeps pouring, and it's overflowing, and just making a whole mess. And the professor says, stop, stop, the cup can't hold anymore. And the Zen master, stops pouring, and he says, right. Now that cup is like your mind. How can I put Zen in your mind if you're so filled up with all your philosophy and all your intellectual sophistication and so forth? You have to come empty. Then we can do something. Why would you do that? Well, for other stuff. And that's why he says creeds in school in abeyance. That's like put them in suspension. Check them at the door. You can pick them up again later. But if when you want to learn something new, you know, I experienced this when in addition to teaching meditation here at Pingree, I teach workshops. This weekend I was up in Massachusetts teaching a couple of workshops. And some of the people that I work with have been doing various kinds of meditation for years. And they're much harder to teach. I much, much rather take some 16-year-old meditation virgin, so to speak. Because you guys just pick it up right away. Oh, the effortlessness of it, the naturalness of it. Whereas people who've done other kinds of meditation, which mostly involve effort and forcing, trying to concentrate, trying to push away thoughts, trying to control the breath and all that. And it's hard for me to get them to just check all that at the door. You know, they always want to bring all that to bear. But notice how careful, how gentle Whitman is with that, because that gets people's back up. People get very attached to their creeds in schools. So he says in the next line, retiring back a while, sufficed it what they are, but never forgotten. Right? You can always pick it up later. I harbor for good or bad. What does it mean to harbor? What does the harbor do to the boats? It contains them, exactly. So I harbor everything. It's a lot like the word assume earlier in the section. I contain everything. As we see here in this mandala idea. I contain everything. Both good and bad. Now, would the Puritans agree with that approach? Yeah. The whole thing that Nathaniel Hawthorne was showing us. That very dualistic attitude. There's good and there's bad, and you have to just harbor the good and exclude the bad. And so everything, and unfortunately, the bad, you know, the good is just the mind, the soul, the spirit, and the bad is the body, everything connected with the body, sexuality. So that gets out there. All the good fun stuff gets out there along with the devil, and that creates all the problems that are explored in the Crucible. So here he said, no, I harbor for good and bad, or bad. I permit to speak at every hazard, right? So in other words, I'm going to harbor, I'm going to assume, include everything in the universe and let it speak through me. I permit to speak at every hazard. In other words, I'm not going to censor myself. I'm not going to say, oh, wait, that's forbidden, that's naughty, that's crazy, that's dangerous. I'm going to let the whole universe speak through me. Wow, what a mission statement. What an audacious project. See, he's kind of making his mission statement here in the first section, telling us what he's going to do for the rest of the poem, for the rest of the book, for the rest of his life. I harbor to, for good or bad, I permit to speak at every hazard, nature without check, with original energy. Nature, the nature of life, the nature of things. Nature is, of course, the woods and the ocean, but it's not just that. It's our own nature. It's our own appetites and lusts and so forth, which are natural. Without check, I'm not going to check myself. I'm not going to hold anything back. I'm going to have, with original energy, the whole original energy of the universe, the whole energy of the Big Bang. I mean, the Big Bang was not known of in this day. But that whatever is the energy of the whole cosmic creation of the universe, I'm going to let it flow through me and come out in words. Are you getting a sense of just this huge thing he's biting off here? No one ever thought of that kind of thing before. And can you see why, for this huge project, audacious project, he needs a huge, audacious, poetic form? You can't fit that into little clipped quatrains like Emily Dickinson. Section 2. Houses and rooms are full of perfumes. Wait a minute. We just talked about free verse. No meter. No rhyme. All of a sudden, there's very obvious rhyme, very sing-songy meter. Houses and rooms are full of perfumes. What's going on? We got to think he meant to do that. It's so obvious. Okay, let's go on and see if you can get a sense of what he might be doing. Houses and rooms are full of perfumes. The shelves are crowded with perfumes. I breathe the fragrance myself and know it and like it. The distillation would intoxicate me also. But I shall not let it. The atmosphere is not a perfume. It has no taste of the distillation. It is odorless. It is for my mouth forever, I am in love with it. I will go to the bank by the wood and become undisguised and naked. I am mad for it to be in contact with me. What's he doing here? What contrast is he drawing? Yeah, between the air, the open air of the outdoors, and the perfume which is found where? Indoors. Between civilization and nature. In civilization, we live in houses and rooms. We live in boxes. You know, people tell you, think outside the box. We construct these boxes. Look, we're sitting in a box right now. It's called a classroom. We build a box, we call it a classroom, and then that defines the kinds of activities we're going to do here. Like, we're probably not going to have a big beer party here. This box defines our behavior within it. We're going to have English class. Civilization, rooms, definition, restriction. And the perfume, there's an artificiality of that. Can you see why he uses meter and rhyme, sing-songy meter and rhyme, to say houses and rooms are full of perfumes? It makes it sound kind of what? Yeah, he's like, exactly, he's mocking it. He's making it sound small, petty, trivial. Because it is, it's limited. And now look what he does with the rhythm. Then when he goes, houses and rooms are full of perfumes. The shelves are crowded with perfumes. Louder? Yes, when he says the shelves are crowded with perfumes, the rhythm itself is crowded. The syllables knock against each other like bottles of perfumes knocking against each other. That's brilliant. When you write, those of you who write Whitman poems, if you can do something that brilliant, you will get a good grade. The shelves are crowded with perfumes. So there he crowds them together and then destroys that meter and moves on. So is he condemning the perfume? No, he's mocking it. But then what does he say? I breathe the fragrance myself and know it and like it. The distillation means the alcohol in it. The distillation, he's saying the perfume is like a liquor. The distillation would intoxicate me also, but I shall not let it. You see the difference between Whitman and Thoreau? Thoreau's like allergic to civilization. Ah, I got to get out of here. I got to get into the woods. In the woods, here I can find God. Here I can find the oversoul. Here I can find nature. Whitman is much more non-dualistic. He's much more inclusive. Oh, civilization? Great. Nature? Great. As long as you don't get intoxicated, as long as you don't get hypnotized, you know, is it great? Is God, is the oversoul to be found in watching television? Sure, God's everywhere. But the problem with television is it's very easy to get hypnotized by television. And then you just get dulled out and that's all you know about. Or playing video games. Or, you know, whatever. Anything that's addictive. Drinking beer, watching video, you know, internet porn, or, you know, whatever people's addictions are. There's nothing wrong with it per se, except that the mind gets fixated on it and misses the wholeness. So you see, he's saying, "Yeah, I appreciate it. But I'm not going to get hypnotized by it. It would intoxicate me also, but I shall not let it." Then there's a little break, and then we see him go to the outdoors. The atmosphere is not a perfume. Boy, you can just taste the. You know, clarity is also a taste. The clarity, the beautiful taste of non-taste. It has no taste of the distillation. It is odorless. It is for my mouth forever. I am in love with it. I will go to the bank by the wood and become undisguised and naked. I am mad for it to be in contact with me. You see how sensual he is. I mean, he's talking about going to the woods. So does Thoreau. But can, in a million years, would Thoreau write a line like that? I'm going to go get naked. I'm mad for it to be in contact with me. You know, it's for Whitman, it's like, oh, I'm going to get naked and just slither through the woods. I just want the woods all over my naked body. He relates to it in a sensual way, and in a sexual way, an erotic way, whereas for Thoreau, it's just much more abstract and spiritual. So we're out of time. Okay, I want you to keep reading. I think you've got a stronger, much stronger sense of what Whitman is about, and I want you to see that as you continue to read. I want you to be, you know, we're going to spend one or two more days on Whitman. I want you to try to get through to the end of Song of Myself, the whole 52 sections, let's say tonight and tomorrow night. So pace yourself with your reading. Okay? Thank you.